Today is Thursday, October 28th, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinua Adofo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, U.S. confirms China's hypersonic missile test.
In an interview with Bloomberg, Milley explicitly confirmed a test and said it was very close to a Sputnik moment.
Plus, U.S. nuclear talks with Iran resume in November.
Iran agreed to come back to the negotiating table with six world powers, reviving hopes of a landmark nuclear deal.
Also, Sudan military strongman fires six envoys as protests continue. Our top story today is in the U.S. The top U.S. military officer, General Mark Milley, has provided the first official U.S. confirmation of a Chinese hypersonic weapons test. Military experts say it appears to show Beijing's pursuit of an Earth-orbiting system designed to evade American missile defenses. Governor Garay of Reuters reports.
Top U.S. military officer General Mark Milley provided the first official U.S. confirmation of what he called a, quote, very concerning Chinese hypersonic weapons test that military experts say appears to show Beijing's pursuit of an Earth-orbiting system designed to evade American missile defenses. The Pentagon has been at pains to avoid direct confirmation of the Chinese test this summer, first reported by the Financial Times, even as President Joe Biden and other officials have expressed general concerns about Chinese hypersonic weapons development. Last week, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin declined to comment directly on that report.
Thanks for asking the question, but I'm not going to comment on those specific reports.
In an interview with Bloomberg, Milley explicitly confirmed a test and said it was very close to a Sputnik moment, referring to Russia's launch of the first man-made satellite, which put Moscow ahead in the Cold War-era space race. Hypersonic weapons are difficult to defend against because they fly at lower altitudes than ballistic missiles but can achieve more than five times the speed of sound, robbing adversaries of reaction time and traditional defeat mechanisms. China's foreign ministry denied a weapons test. It said it had carried out a routine test in July, but added it was not a missile, it was a space vehicle. The United States and Russia have both tested hypersonic weapons.
Nuclear talks with six major powers will resume by the end of November, Iran's top nuclear negotiator Ali Bagheri-Khani tweeted on Wednesday after meeting with European Union officials in Brussels. Gloria So of Reuters reports.
Iran agreed to come back to the negotiating table with six world powers, reviving hopes of a landmark nuclear deal. That's according to Iran's top nuclear negotiator after meeting with EU officials in Brussels. On Wednesday, Ali Bagheri-Khani tweeted, quote, had a very serious and constructive dialogue with Enrique Mora on the essential elements for successful negotiations. We agree to start negotiations before the end of November. Talks on Geneva had stalled after the election of Iran's hardline president, Ibrahim Raisi, in June. Raisi is expected to take a tougher approach with the West. Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian on Wednesday said U.S. President Joe Biden needed to demonstrate his commitment to negotiations.
I personally believe that if Mr. Biden is serious, then he should show this so that we can believe that the Americans are actually serious about lifting sanctions.
Spearheaded by American diplomats in 2015, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA, lifted global sanctions on Iran in exchange for limits on Tehran's nuclear program. 3 years later, Republican President Donald Trump quit the deal and imposed new sanctions. Iran then resumed enriching uranium beyond limits set by the JCPOA. Under Democratic President Joe Biden, the U.S. has called for a return to the deal, but Iran has insisted on sanctions relief first. U.S. Special Envoy for Iran Robert Malley said earlier this week that efforts to revive the pact were at a, quote, critical phase, and Tehran's reasons for avoiding talks were wearing thin.
That's Gloria Tso of Reuters. A Sudanese military official says General Abdel Fattah Burhan has fired at least six ambassadors, including the country's envoys to the U.S., the European Union, and France. Also fired were the ambassadors to the U.N. mission in Geneva, Qatar, and China. The dismissals came late Wednesday after the diplomats spoke out against the military's takeover. U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken this week spoke with deposed Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok, who was released from custody Tuesday. The U.S. is calling for a return to the civilian-led transition to democracy, as VOA senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sane reports.
As pro-civilian government protesters in Sudan's capital blocked traffic with small brick barricades, the international community was swift to condemn this week's military takeover in Sudan. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
I once again strongly condemned the forceful military takeover of power in Sudan. And I urge, of course, all stakeholders to exercise maximum restraint.
The U.S. Deputy Representative to the United Nations, Richard Mills Jr.
We have said repeatedly, any changes to the transitional government by force in Khartoum puts at risk U.S. assistance.
Sudan's leading general, Abdel Fattah Burhan, said he was dissolving the country's ruling sovereign council, as well as the government led by Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok, in an effort, in his words, to preserve the path of the magnificent December Revolution until its final goals are achieved. But in Washington, State Department spokesperson Ned Price said the Sudanese military has subverted the democratic aspirations of the Sudanese people. He outlined U.S. goals in this situation, working with the international community.
An immediate release of all political actors detained in connection with these events, a full restoration of the civilian-led transitional government, and a refraining from any violence against peaceful protesters, including the use of live ammunition. And we strongly condemn recent reports of violence against peaceful protesters.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken called Prime Minister Hamdok late Tuesday, welcomed his release from custody, and emphasized U.S. support for the civilian-led transition to democracy. Diplomatic outreach in the region is exactly what is needed right now, Joseph Tucker of the U.S. Institute of Peace told VOA.
I hope there's engagement with Egypt because that's the crux of the matter, is that the military and those aligned with the military feel, again, whether explicit or not, that they do have the backing of the region. So that high-level U.S. government attention is critical.
The State Department has called on the Sudanese military to refrain from any violence against peaceful protesters, which includes not using live ammunition. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
Once commonplace, abuses by state security forces against civilians in Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger have dropped sharply, according to rights groups. Reporting from Burkina Faso, where the decline of 77% has been the biggest, Henry Wilkins discovered what is behind the drop and what lessons can be learned.
Abuses by security forces in the Sahel conflict, where Burkina Faso, Mali and Niger battle terror groups linked to Islamic State and Al-Qaeda, were extremely common. Last year, the number of civilian fatalities caused by the security forces was approaching those caused by terror groups. Data from the Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project, ACLED, shows the number of civilian fatalities caused by security forces have fallen dramatically in the last year to October 1st, compared with the previous year. They've dropped by 77% in Burkina Faso, 74% in Mali, and 65% in Niger. Rights groups say they've also observed the change and suggest why it might have occurred. Karine Dufka is the West Africa Director at Human Rights Watch.
We believe that there's a combination of factors. First has been reporting by human rights groups, by journalists, as well as pressure from the international community.
Analysts say there could be other factors at play, including the outsourcing of military activities to government-backed militias, among other things. Andrew Leibovich is with the European Council on Foreign Relations.
Over this period, the security situation in the Sahel has continued to get worse. And so I think one other possible explanation is that regional security forces are doing somewhat less patrolling, actually doing somewhat less, fewer operations where they're actually interacting with populations in rural areas, especially.
The Burkinabe Army says accusations of abuse by security forces have not been proven. In a statement to VOA, it said respect for human rights is a major concern for the National Armed Forces and is part of the basic education for soldiers. But the consequences of the atrocities are not going away, says Dufka.
Bad news is there have not been investigations, much less justice and accountability.
Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Ouagadougou.
More troops and people are crossing the heavily fortified Pakistan and Afghanistan border after Islamabad eased restrictions providing needed relief as economic conditions worsen in Kabul and several other districts. The UN Refugee Agency said the action reduces the chances of people turning to human smugglers to cross the borders. For the situation at the border, I spoke with VOA's Ayaz Gaur.
There are still thousands of people sitting sort of camped on the Afghan side of the border, hoping that they will be able to cross into Pakistan. And that situation emerged last week after Pakistani foreign minister visited the Afghan capital Kabul, held talks with Taliban. And then after his talks, Pakistan announced a set of measures to facilitate cross-border movement for traders, for the transit trade that Afghanistan does through Pakistan, and also issuing visas at the border crossing for patients who come here for healthcare in Pakistan, and also giving visas to students who study in Pakistani universities. So the moment they were announced, the next morning, we saw thousands of people march towards the border from inside Afghanistan, and they are still camped there, but Taliban security forces on their side are preventing anybody who does not have a valid visa to enter into Pakistan. There's a very tight border control on the Pakistani side, and any person with a valid visa, even when enters Pakistan, has to go to certain fingerprints and other identification procedure.
Are the authorities on both sides doing anything to facilitate or to quicken the process as thousands are still there? It's getting cold and such humanitarian conditions at the border. It's not what the government had in mind.
From our sources, we understand that Taliban are also quietly telling Pakistani authorities to not let anybody cross the border into Pakistan who even has a valid visa, because understandably, Taliban know that so many people have left Afghanistan over the last 2 months, and the more migration toward neighboring countries is also an embarrassing situation for the Taliban, because it is giving this impression that nobody wants to stay in Afghanistan under the Taliban rule. So we understand that there is some kind of a covert effort going on to prevent these Afghan families from leaving the country. So we really don't see any effort from both sides other than Pakistan announcing repeatedly that nobody not having a proper visa for Pakistan will be allowed into the country. So it's a situation, obviously, which is terrible for the families, for the kids, because the temperature is also dropping quickly there in that area of the border between the two countries. It's very cold there.
With a potential humanitarian crisis brewing at that border, some analysts fear people might take desperate measures, including smuggling or in any way just to get away, either into Pakistan or get away from what is going on at the border.
We know already some of these mafias type of networks, you know, illegal networks have already actively working in that area, trying to smuggle people through informal routes into Pakistan. But until 5 or 6 years ago, it would have been easier for them. But since Pakistan has fenced the border with Afghanistan, there are only few regular crossings left, and there's a lot of monitoring going on with drones deployed there, surveillance. So it will not be easy for these traditional illegal networks of human smuggling.
That's VOA's Ayaz Gaur speaking with me from Islamabad. This is the Voice of America. An investigation by the Associated Press found that Myanmar military has been torturing detainees across the country in a methodical and systematic way since its takeover of the government in February. The AP investigation was based on interviews with 28 people imprisoned and released in recent months, photographic evidence, sketches and letters, and testimony from three recently defected military officials. The French government on Thursday said it will adopt a zero-tolerance attitude towards Britain and block access to virtually all its boats until it awards sufficient licenses France says its fishermen need. France seized the British trawler fishing in its territorial water without a license on Thursday and issued a warning to a second vessel in a dispute over access to fishing grounds after Brexit. You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu for broadcasting from Washington, D.C. The UN Refugee Agency reports it has restarted a voluntary repatriation operation for thousands of refugees from the Central African Republic who were living in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Over the past 2 years, the UN Refugee Agency has helped more than 5,000 refugees return from Congo to the Central African Republic. The voluntary operation, which has been interrupted on two occasions, resumed on Friday. The program was first halted in March 2020, when both countries closed their borders to prevent the spread of COVID-19. The second interruption occurred last December, when violence surrounding the CAR presidential elections sent an estimated 92,000 refugees fleeing into the DRC. UNHCR spokeswoman Shabia Mantu says a first group of 250 refugees left Mole Camp to Zongo City in the northwestern DRC last Friday. She says a second group of 250 people left the camp on Tuesday morning. Later in the day, she says a 20-minute boat ride will ferry the refugees across the Ubangi River to Bangui, the CAR capital.
People are only returning to areas where security has improved in the past 6 months, such as Bangui and the prefectures of Mbele, Mpoko and Lobai. Most of those set to return fled their homes because of violence in 2013. UNHCR and partners will soon organise voluntary repatriation flights for refugees living in Inke Camp in north of Bangui province, and air transport is necessary due to the distances and poor roads.
The voluntary repatriation began in November 2019. That followed the signing of a tripartite agreement between the CAR and DRC in July. Mantu says nearly 10,000 refugees in three camps hosting them have signed up for voluntary repatriation.
UNHCR is providing assistance to the returning refugees and together with partners is working on reintegration projects in CAR, including in education and agriculture. Some 206,346 CAR refugees live in camps and with host communities in DRC's three provinces, and UNHCR and partners plan to assist 6,500 of them to return this year.
Since violence between armed groups erupted in 2013, more than 680,000 refugees and asylum seekers have fled to Cameroon, the DRC, the Republic of the Congo, and Chad. About a third are being hosted in DRC. Another 630,000 people are displaced within Central African Republic. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The Global Center on Adaptation says climate change will push 120 million people into extreme poverty by 2030, and a third of them will be Africans if nothing is done to mitigate its effects. The findings are in the center's report on Africa, released Tuesday. Mohamed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Speaking in Nairobi at the release of a report looking at present-day and future climate change risks in Africa, the head of the Global Center on Adaptation, Patrick Vauquin, says the climate crisis may create millions of poor people on the continent.
In fact, worldwide, climate change, if unchecked, will push 122 million new people into extreme poverty by 2030. Of these, in sub-Saharan Africa alone, 43 million new poor people pushed into poverty by climate change. And even if development is rapid and inclusive, up to 12 million people in Africa could be pushed into poverty in this time due to climate change alone.
The Netherlands-based organization that works on climate adaptation solutions around the globe said Africa's failure to adapt to the recurrent climate shocks will also increase the cost of borrowing, reducing investment opportunities for its people. According to the Africa Development Bank, AFDB, the continent needs $7 to $15 billion a year to create adaptation programs. Akinwumi Adesina, the Africa Development Bank president, says it is making $25 billion available to scale up climate change adaptation actions and drive investment in green growth.
We will scale up access to climate-smart digital technologies and associated data-driven agricultural and financial services to at least 30 million farmers in Africa. Infrastructure. We will ensure that climate risk and resilience are integrated in at least 50% of total value of new infrastructure investments in Africa across all infrastructure sectors.
The AFDB said it will invest $8 billion to create sustainable jobs for Africa's youth and innovative financial initiatives that help increase financial flows for adaptation and resilience. Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta, addressing the gathering online, said his government is ready to handle the adverse effect of climate change.
To implement our nationally determined contributions, we plan to invest approximately $8 billion over the next 10 years. This is just 10% of the total investment needed of the NDCs, and we therefore need support from our international partners.
Vauquhain says, apart from the effort to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees, investing in communication tools, water and health can help Africa.
A dollar invested in weather and climate information services, $1, gives between $4 and $25 in benefits. A dollar invested in resilient water and sanitation not only saves lives, it creates between $2 and $12 in benefits. African countries that invest a dollar in climate-smart crops can see between $2 and $14 in benefits. Adaptation, again, the central message, makes economic sense.
High-level officials and heads of state from around the world are scheduled to meet in Glasgow, Scotland on Sunday for the COP26 climate summit and to accelerate action towards the goals of the 2019 Paris Agreement meant to limit global warming. Mohamed Yusuf for VA News, Nairobi.
While a new and promising COVID-19 treatment is being evaluated for emergency use in the United States, there's new financial backing to get this breakthrough drug to the rest of the world. VOA's Caroline Prasuti explains.
These pills carry hope for those who catch COVID. The drug manufacturer Merck says molnupiravir prevents the coronavirus from multiplying. Taken early, clinical trials show the pill reduces the risk of hospitalization or death by half, and it's easy to use. If the Food and Drug Administration approves Merck's request for emergency use, the pills could be available in the U.S. before the end of the year. The company plans similar emergency use applications worldwide. But financing and distributing this drug and other treatments, including vaccines, to underdeveloped parts of the world remains a challenge. The U.S. has pre-purchased 1.7 million courses of the drug. To help get the drug to the rest of the world faster, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is putting up $120 million to push makers of generic drugs to produce Merck's drug for developing countries. Money is at the heart of any COVID treatment. Dr. Caleb Hernandez is an emergency room doctor who also researches COVID drug discoveries. He says three other drug treatments have been studied, including one that rivals Merck's claims for molnupiravir. He says they lack the financial backing to seek FDA approval. And there is concern about relying on the Merck pill instead of getting a vaccine, which experts prefer since it teaches the body to make its own antibodies. Nearly 5 million deaths worldwide and closing in on 740,000 American deaths from COVID, with an artist paying tribute with a white flag for each. Caroline Prasuti, VOA News.
The United States has issued its first passport with unquote X unquote gender designation for people who don't identify as male or female. The State Department says it expects to offer the option more broadly early next year. The department didn't identify the passport recipient, but Dana Zaim of Fort Collins, Colorado, tells the Associated Press in a telephone interview it was their passport. Zaim, who prefers a gender neutral pronoun, has been in a legal battle with the government since 2015 over a passport. Zaim said the fight for the passport with an accurate gender designation was a way to help the next generation of intersex people win recognition as full citizens with rights. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofoedu in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a pleasant evening.